And we're back. We're back, I think. And this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Rabbi David Mivaser, is going to be talking tonight at 7 p.m. in the New Vision United Church. That is in a couple of hours. And he joins us now. Are you there, Rabbi David Mivaser? Thanks very much for joining us. You've been doing rather brave work. You've been at the you have recently been on part of protests in Israel, or I guess on the West Bank, pardon me, the occupied West Bank. You're with Independent Jewish Voices, are you not?
Well, here in Canada, I'm an active member of Independent Jewish Voices. That's right.
Yeah.
And I was in Palestine and in Israel, which is actually the same place.
I'm glad you made the point.
Went with a group called the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, and be very happy to tell you and your listeners about it.
Okay.
But, you know, I just want to make a comment.
Yes.
You're giving me a very generous introduction, and you said I did some brave things, but you know, the risk that I take on as a Jewish person and as an international, it's virtually nothing compared to the people who live there day in and day out. You know, especially I'm referring to the Palestinians, Palestinian partners of the organization that we worked with, the people that were there with us. They are the ones that are really taking risks.
Well, it is a great step of solidarity, and I agree with you, of course, that the life of the Palestinian, particularly in one of the places that I read about, the village of Sarura, and I believe there's others where you were part of protests. What is the crisis here? As I understand it, this village, people were forcefully removed from that village. Is that what, 20 years ago? Is that the story?
Yes, it's a very common story. So just give you a bit of background. This is a place in the South Hebron Hills, which is the southernmost part of what was left as the Palestinian territories when 1949 armistice line was drawn between the State of Israel and what was left that was actually taken by the Kingdom of Jordan. And then the Israelis conquered it in 67. So it's a very southern part of that area. It's south of Hebron. I could say it's north of Beersheba. And a very sparsely populated, kind of barren area, you know. It's just like very rocky and dry, and just little teeny scrubby little plants grow there. So it was really inhabited by Bedouin, who are traditional herders. They do a bit of farming. It's actually amazing how they can, and they do grow things there. You know, they grow wheat and they grow vegetables and things like that, but mostly by herding. So it was very, very sparsely populated. And then after 67, the Israelis started planting settlements there, which was more of an ideological thing rather than any kind of practical. It's not like practically a great place to live. But it was a way for Jews to assert control and domination over that land, and to, you know, people very ideologically motivated to do that. So typically what would happen is the Israeli government would establish a military base. The military base would take land away, and the military base would be there for a few years, and then civilian settlers would move in, take it over, and the military would withdraw. And then they would just, the settlers, these civilian people, would have the land. So very specifically, this place you just referred to as Sarura, it was a tiny, I wouldn't even call it a village. It was like one family with a couple different branches, you know, like the grandpa and two or three sons with their wives and their children, living there for generations, actually in caves. They're cave dwellers. Which suited them just fine.
That's their life.
They have so little. You know, they have herds of sheep and clothes and a few implements and things like that. Very simple life. So settlers harass them like crazy. Just kind of constant, violent harassment. Harass the children, harass the herds. Israel declared this area a firing zone so the Israeli military could practice weapons, you know? So no one was allowed to live there for their own safety. and these people had to be removed, supposedly for their own safety, but I think it was just a land grab. And that happened more than 20 years ago. And the group that I was with very consciously partnered with about four or five other groups, including a couple of Palestinian groups, who live there in the cities, in either Bethlehem or in Hebron. They worked together like for 10 months to prepare this action. They had to find people who wanted us to come and help them because, as I just said, once we leave, they are so vulnerable to being attacked and not attacked politely. I mean, like really brutally attacked and driven out again. So the Palestinian partners found this family who was forced to leave about 20 years ago. They were interested in going back to this land that they own. There's no dispute about the legal ownership. It's kind of strange that Israel, in this particular case of this family in this land, Israel acknowledges that they own the land. They're just not allowed to live there.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to build anything. They're not allowed to even like have like a water pipe. They have no electricity, no water, no road.
Mm-hmm.
There's no schools that their kids can go to. There's no medical coverage. There's no nothing. It's just they own this land, and they want to be there.
Yeah.
So,
well, by the way, I saw the photograph.
We helped them get back to it. That was 11 days ago.
Yeah, and people can go to Rabbi David Miviser's site. I mean, I just Googled your name, and it's lovely. I found all those pictures. I think the old gentleman, you were with him, he must have been thrilled.
Yeah.
He was sitting there at the fire with
the
people, Jewish groups in solidarity and Palestinians. By the way, I hope he's okay. Where does it stand now? I mean, you can only do this a certain amount of time, right? Before, and then you have
to. Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I'll just tell you the outcome. There's no final outcome. It's never over, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be good to just tell you more of the story. But this morning in Israel, the army came with bulldozers and confiscated everything. They took everything.
Where you were.
I'm sorry?
I just said where you were. That spot, like with the pic where I saw those photographs, they've come there with bulldozers.
Yes. In other words, they took the tent, they took the water cans, they took the pots and pans. And this fellow named Fadl Omar, he has a car. They confiscated his car. They took everything. They destroyed and took everything. They didn't hurt the people, and they didn't take the people away.
It's like a war of attrition on a civilian population.
Well, it has been constant. I think it's been constantly that way since 1948.
Yeah.
Greater pressure in some places, less in others. But it's been a constant process.
Now, I want to ask you about this ongoing and the efforts that you're making and the Palestinians are making. I'm interested in whether you're seeing some change. There seems to be, certainly internationally, the mood seems to be changing on the issue. And I saw photographs of a Peace Now demonstration really seemed large. And for years, Peace Now seemed rather quiet. Now, you were at, I think you told me earlier, you were at those demonstrations. So what was being said there, and what's the mood? Are people more hopeful?
It was just the night before last. I was there. I went from there to the airport and came back to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to be honest with you, it wasn't very large. It felt good. There were a lot of people there. But that number of, when I say a lot of people, was maybe 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, a rally like this could draw 400 or 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So my own assessment is that there are a lot of Israelis who want the situation to change for the better, meaning they want to end the occupation. They want to withdraw the settlements and withdraw their army. They want to stop ruling over another people. When I say there's a lot, honestly, I don't know if that's even a majority. But I think those who feel that way are quite tired, and I think they don't have an expectation there will be change.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it very discouraging to work for it. I spoke with Israelis on this trip. Mm-hmm. So tell me, you know, every 4 years they go and they vote for the parties that say they'll do those things. Mm-hmm. And some of them get elected to the parliament.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't change for the better. It's been slowly, slowly changing for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the parties and the people who get elected and who are in control of the political,
yes,
you know, the political structure are just pushing more and more for harsher treatment of Palestinians, more settlements, more building, and more actual restrictions on civil liberties within Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say there were a lot of people at this rally,
yeah, well, they're
well, yeah. It was disappointing for a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, now that is interesting. I have to say, you know, just as an outside observer, you know, watching, there was the reports were that, you know, basically that Peace Now was not able any longer to have these. So when I see any size demonstration, I take heart from it. But I have to agree that at one time it looked like they were going to be over the top and make it with the numbers at 400,000, as you say. By the way, there was an assassination of a prime minister. The situation there is quite ugly. My memory is that there's some people celebrate the man who killed him, committed that assassination.
That's right. So
pretty discouraging. That is discouraging. Now, tell us about the political prisoners. The news here was that there were 1,700 political prisoners. There was a hunger strike. They seem to have, I guess, through the maybe international attention or whatnot, some degree of progress was made on that front. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, some of them I think you can call political prisoners. Some of them are more like security prisoners, and others are just people that are just in the wrong place at the wrong time and got picked up. So they have all different backgrounds. I wouldn't say that they're necessarily political prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have really committed acts of violence in resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think the victory that they achieved is very, I think the victory is more of a, maybe a kind of an emotional or spiritual victory, just the fact that they banded together, that many of them cooperated with each other across their own political lines. They have very sharp divisions among themselves, but they were able to work together to stage this hunger strike. They kept it going for 40 days. And in the end, they got some concessions from the Israeli prison authorities. But actually, if you look at the details, I think it's very, very minor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the main thing that I understand is now they can have family visits twice a month instead of once a month.
Mm-hmm.
However, many of them are imprisoned inside Israel proper, not in the territories. Then, therefore, their families can't visit them at all unless they get a permit. Each family member has to have a permit for every single visit to cross that line. It can take them weeks and weeks. They can just not get the permit. They can get the permit and then on a practical level not be able to travel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to say that they won a victory because now they can have two family visits a month instead of one, it's a rather minor thing. I mean, there's many people that are in prison for years and years and years for just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
People told me that themselves. I met a man who was in prison for 8 years. He told me for throwing stones. I met another man whose son got sick, and he just was in a place where some other young men were doing something like throwing stones, and the Israelis took him off the prison.
Mm-hmm.
It's military law, military court. The conviction rate, I've read, is 99.7%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are people in prison that don't even belong in prison at all, and they can stay there for years.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what you're hearing me say sounds very pessimistic. I'm kind of downplaying.
I'm sure you'll find a
the victories. So I want to say just part of my conclusion is that I think it's important to keep up efforts to make political change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually very pessimistic about that in any foreseeable time frame. I think the The powers that be are so entrenched and so convinced of their way that it's unlikely to change.
Yeah.
And what is hopeful to me is being able to support Palestinians in simply maintaining their existence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an expression that existence is resistance.
Yes.
There's a kind of resistance by simply staying there, staying on the land, staying in their homes. If they have work, going to work every day, the kids going to school every day.
That's right.
You know, growing some crops, whatever it is. So I feel like that's what we accomplished. We were able to kind of show up to provide a kind of moral or spiritual support in some ways to help people actually deal with some of the physical pressures that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by doing that, we're able to just strengthen people to deal with really difficult circumstances, even when we can't change the circumstances.
Well, Rabbi, I think, by the way, that the spiritual business to survive, the spirit is absolutely essential. I think that's why individuals like yourself have come forward and have what it takes to stay in there. But tell us about the phrase I read that your mission is from the phrase pursue justice and pursue peace. And I assume that is where you start. You've been in this struggle for 25 years, United States, Canada, and Israel. But tell us about that.
Well, within the Jewish religion, there's the idea that God commands us to do certain things. I can step out of the religious language and say something like, the universe is structured in such a way that when we do certain things, it has very positive consequences. It changes things. It makes the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
So in our religious tradition, there are many, 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 many commandments, many things we're commanded to do. But there are only two of them where the Bible uses the word pursue. Everything else, we're supposed to do it when the opportunity comes up. But there are two things that the Bible says, God tells us, pursue these, which means go out of our way. Get up out of our place of comfort and go look for opportunities and do it. And in the book of Leviticus, it says, justice, justice, you shall pursue. And then in Psalms, it says, seek peace and pursue it. So our religious tradition tells us that's what we need to do, you know, to be like a good person and just kind of be kind and be pleasant and be generous and all these things, that's really good. We should all do that. But in addition, we actually have to go out and seek peace and pursue it and pursue justice. So that's what this little trip was about, actually.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's such a little trip. I think you never know when one of those little things turn out to be the one. Rabbi, we're very grateful you talk to us, and at 7 o'clock tonight,
you
are talking at the New Vision United Church, 24 Main Street West in Hamilton. I think Hamilton's very fortunate you're going to be there. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break and come back and speak to steelworker Representative Mike Hirsch.